From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, investigating mass murder in Serb-run concentration camps and the systematic rape of Bosnian women. Journalist Roy Gutman was the first to report in depth on what he describes as the death camps of Bosnia. This year, he won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on atrocities in the Balkans. His stories led to the closing down of two camps. Now his Pulitzer Prize-winning reports are collected in a new book. He'll tell us how he tracked down the stories. And TV critic David Bianculli previews the new season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The presidents of Croatia and Bosnia have agreed to stop fighting immediately and allow free passage for all relief convoys. They have also promised to resolve territorial disputes. This clears the way for renewed peace talks. The two leaders spoke for 4 hours today in Geneva. Croatian President Franjo Tudjman says both sides will close all prisoner camps. After protests by thousands of his supporters, the leader of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia, Eduard Shevardnadze, said he may
Latinos, blacks, Native Americans, and Asians are taking the test and scoring slightly better. I'm Claudio Sanchez in Washington.
The astronauts aboard the space shuttle Discovery are conducting experiments today. Meanwhile, the German telescope they put into space has begun its work. The telescope is trailing the shuttle by 35 miles. It is peering at distant stars. The crew is also using the shuttle's camera-equipped robot arm to look closely at a metal ring in the payload bay. The ring, part of a satellite cradle, was slightly damaged while the satellite was being deployed on Sunday. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Cherry Gross. Journalist Roy Gutman won a Pulitzer Prize this year for what the judges described as courageous and persistent reporting that disclosed atrocities and other human rights violations in Croatia and Bosnia. In the summer of 92, Gutman gave the first lengthy accounts of mass murders in the prison camps of Bosnia. His newspaper, New York Newsday, headlined one of his stories, The Death Camps of Bosnia. The report was picked up by news media worldwide. His reports on ethnic cleansing in Bosnia are collected in the new book, A Witness to Genocide. We invited him to talk with us about how he investigated rumors of mass slaughter. First, I want you to hear one of his reports on the prison in Brčko, in which he estimates Serbs killed 3,000 Bosnians during a 6-week period last year. Many of the bodies were dumped in the Sava River. His report was based on the stories of survivors. This was datelined August 2, 1992.
Lujunovic, a 53-year-old Muslim, said he was only one of 150 prisoners still alive of the 1,500 who had arrived at the beginning of May. After slaughtering 9/10 of the prisoners, the guards turned on townspeople who had not been captured, he told Newsday during a 2-hour interview. Then, instead of tossing these bodies into the Sava, they had prisoners drive them to an animal feed plant, he said. Lujunovic said the prisoners didn't actually throw the corpses into the oven, but they had every reason to believe the bodies were being cremated for animal feed, for that day the air in Brčko would stink so badly you couldn't open the window. Lujunovic was a traffic engineer employed by the city of Brčko in northeast Bosnia when the Yugoslav army, directed from Serbia, launched an assault to capture a land corridor through northern Bosnia in early May. He said he experienced nearly every form of humiliation the Serb captors inflicted on Muslim prisoners, from desecration of the local mosque to witnessing the murder and mutilation of male prisoners and the gang rape of Muslim women. Sometimes the prisoners were subjected to horrible mutilations before they were tossed into the Sava. The very worst day, and I saw it with my own eyes, was when I saw 10 young men laid out in a row. They had their throats slit, their noses cut off, and their genitals plucked out. It was the worst thing I saw, he said. A Serb guard appeared before the prisoners, who were made to observe the killings. He had a homemade wire device with 3 prongs attached to a long handle. He threatened to castrate us, Lujunovic said. The first to be executed were the Muslim political party members and the Bosnian Home Guard, he said. They called out names, took out the prisoners, and started killing. We would hear 3 shots, and the man would not come back, Lujunovic recalled. But they soon switched methods and began slitting throats of prisoners, he said. They would tell them to lie down and put their head on a concrete block. The guards would cut their throats. I saw it with my own eyes. The bodies were positioned so that the blood flowed into the Sava. And finally, after about a month of executions, the guards started executing the townspeople, he said.
And that's Roy Gutman reading from an article he wrote for Newsday on August 2nd, 1992. The article is included in his new collection of articles, and these articles won a Pulitzer Prize for international reporting. Roy Gutman, how did you get onto the story of what was happening in the concentration camps?
It began with a trip to the town of Banja Luka, which is the biggest Serb town in Bosnia. About half the population of 200,000 are Serbs. And I had heard a rumor that something was going on in the town. Ethnic cleansing had begun, and that would have been a terrible thing because there were at least 100,000 non-Serbs there. And I called up the local Muslim party leader, a man who, by the way, has just been arrested and apparently now is in jail, and according to the report I just heard, is being tortured there. And I asked what was going on in Banja Luka. He said, in the name of God, please come to Banja Luka. We have terrible things happening here. We want to tell you about them, and we'll give you all the information we can. He assisted me, as did local politicians from the Croat and the Muslim parties, in putting together a series of stories that I did. At the moment that I got there, people were being deported from northern Bosnia through Banja Luka in trains, in closed freight cars. And the Muslims there were not allowed, when the trains passed through the station, even to provide water. This is the middle of summer. Or food, but they could see people's hands sticking out of the little cracks in the freight cars. And they gave me a complete schedule of these trains, how many had run, how many people approximately were thought to be on them, where they thought they had gone.
Who gave you the schedule?
This was the local Muslim and Croat political leaders in mm-hmm. Banja Luka. Mm-hmm. And then I got it confirmed. I talked to the Serb police chief, who said yes, they were using these trains to deport people. He said the passengers on the trains did not ask to go in first class carriages, and that all the Serbs had to deport them was freight cars. So that's why they used them. And then I heard stories while I was there that I didn't even expect to hear, and this was that this network of camps had been set up throughout northern Bosnia, one of which was in Omarska, about 20 miles from Banja Luka, and others dotted across the countryside. We talk about camps, but they weren't purpose-built. They were basically, let's say, industrial complexes that were turned into concentration camps. And they had the Muslim party, it's called the SDA party, and the Muslim charity in Banja Luka had both gotten a report from somebody who had visited Omarska at great risk to her own life and had seen prisoners in a huge outdoor... Now, Omarska itself is an iron mine, and she apparently saw these prisoners in a huge outdoor mine area, open ore mine, and in mud... In the most awful possible human conditions, with almost no food, no toilets, no shelter, but I couldn't even find that witness. The witness was afraid for her life, but I just made a mental note at that point that I had to do everything possible to find out what was really going on in the camp.
Well, how do you find that out? I mean, they're not going to give you admission to a death camp. They're not going to give you a tour of it so that you can survey circumstances. How did you track down people to tell you the story, and enough people so that you could feel confident that what you were hearing was true?
It was one of the most frustrating moments I could have imagined in life, because the story had the ring of authenticity to it, but I couldn't go there, as you've suggested. I did the first obvious thing was to ask to go there.
You asked the Serbs if
yes,
you could go.
Yes, yeah. I said I'd heard that the place... some terrible stories about it, and I just wanted to check them out.
And they said?
that they said they couldn't guarantee my safety. So it was a way of saying, if you want to go, you may be a prisoner there yourself. And I just tried to think of what could I do to find evidence, to find bear out the stories, or whatever was going on in the camp. And for the first thing I did was I wrote a story about it. Now, ordinarily, one never writes a story based on hearsay, on a secondhand witness. But this somehow had the ring of authenticity to it. And so I said this was not a witness that Newsday had contacted, but that who had come to the Muslim authorities in Banja Luka. I contacted the International Red Cross. They also had picked up stories of this sort. I contacted the UN High Commission for Refugees, which had many people in the region. I contacted the European Community, who had monitors. I contacted the U.S. Embassy in Belgrade. And from all of these different international observers, I got a very strong impression that the story could well be true, but none of them could supply a witness. None of them had information that they thought was so airtight that they would give it to me. So after puzzling it over for a while, I came to the conclusion, with the guidance of my own editors, that I should go to wherever the biggest gathering point was for refugees from, for Muslim refugees from central Bosnia. And that happened to be Zagreb in Croatia, in neighboring Croatia at that time. They were arriving by the hundreds daily. They had no shelter to speak of. And I went there to the Muslim charity Merhamet, and I said, I want you to scour the refugee camps. I want you to find people for me who had been in Omarska. I'd heard by this point that a few people had gotten out, men over 65, boys under 16, that for some reason the Serb officials running the camp decided to let them out. So for, I don't know, 10 days or so, they searched. They found maybe a dozen witnesses for me from Omarska, and they found Mr. Lujinovic, who had been in Brčko, Luka. Of the dozen witnesses, really only two or three seemed either coherent or seemed credible. Most of them had stories, but they just didn't quite figure.
What was the minimum that you needed to go with this story in print?
Well, I decided in my own head I needed either two witnesses from the same camp or one witness from each of two camps. It was just an arbitrary rule. But I felt I needed at least a couple of stories. And then the second thing was I needed, I decided I had to have a picture of the witnesses because their stories were so extraordinary. Even if I couldn't use their names. And so that was the device we used in Newsday. We had their pictures on page one. And I think that alone drove it home, that these were real people and that they had a real story to tell.
Were your stories attacked for not being substantiated?
Oddly enough, they weren't. Because for one thing, just the fact of having the pictures made it clear that these were real people. Secondly, the story contained comments from every responsible international organization, including the Red Cross. The Red Cross had tried by this time to go to Omarska, for example, and they'd been denied admittance. And one of their spokesmen said to me, if this is not a death camp, then there's no reason the Serbs wouldn't allow us in.
Well, in fact, you say that the Serbs closed the Omarska camp after your Newsday report, and they dispersed the prisoners to other places. And then after that, they opened the camp to the Red Cross.
Yes, and to the press. You know, somebody in the Red Cross in Banja Luka told me that at a certain point, about 3 or 4 days after my story appeared, they saw trucks driving through Banja Luka full of bedding, of mattresses and bed frames. Heading toward Omarska. And this man, who was then the head of the Red Cross there, said, we think they're about to open up the Omarska camp. They had raided a hotel in Banja Luka to provide to find beds, and they were transporting them to Omarska. They set them up in the basement of the administration building at this camp, and then invited in the press. And they told the press that this is where the prisoners slept, in this kind of Potemkin dormitory. So that was one indication. Now, the other thing is a number of reporters in the 2 or 3 days after my story appeared tried to go there. And the first ones to be successful were from the British television network ITN and a reporter from The Guardian. They went to Omarska about 3 days after the story appeared. And they found prisoners there, only a few hundred, because by that time the vast majority had been moved to other locations.
My guest is Roy Guttman, foreign correspondent for Newsday. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Roy Guttman. His Pulitzer Prize-winning reports on ethnic cleansing in Bosnia are collected in the new book, A Witness to Genocide. The Newsday headline that ran over your story about your first story about the mass executions in camps was Death Camps of Bosnia. What did you think of that headline? What did you think of the use of the word death camps?
I thought it was accurate. I am more convinced now than ever that it was accurate. Mm-hmm. It was a very controversial headline because death camps from the period of the Nazi Holocaust are associated as, in most people's minds, as like Auschwitz, a factory where you take people and in an industrial method exterminate them. In the case of Omarska and Birchko, as from the passage I read earlier, and also from the evidence that's been gathered in the meantime, we can't say that these were factories, but that people were killed daily, arbitrarily, 10, 20, 50, 100 a day, mostly beaten. Some died of starvation. And that most of the people there would have died if they hadn't been freed by that point.
How graphic did you want your writing to be about the camps in Bosnia? I mean, in some of the articles, you have some fairly graphic descriptions of castrations, of the slitting of throats, of rape. And, I mean, there always is that question in photographs and in stories when you're describing something gruesome, how explicit to be.
I guess from my early days as a wire service reporter, I've always tried to observe the maxim of using no adjectives in my writing, or as few as possible. And basically to try to relate the substance is the most important thing, unadorned, straightforwardly. And I felt that that was the only way to be convincing, that it needed no embellishment, that the stories of the witnesses simply should be told as directly as possible.
Can I tell you what to me was really just one of the most revealing yet straightforward things that you wrote, that it's really in keeping of what you're describing, just telling the facts instead of, you know, using a lot of adjectives. You were describing the mass rapes of women in Bosnia, and you said that many of these women were found to have staph and other vaginal infections, the kind of bacteria that is usually spread by dirt and fecal matter. And that I thought that was so revealing, yet straightforward.
I have to tell you, when I heard this from the gynecologists in Tuzla, that my initial reaction was that I just wanted to scream.
Yeah.
And I simply couldn't grasp it. And I didn't know really how to deal with it. You know, there are times as a reporter when you just don't know what the next question is to ask, because it's just simply so staggering. And I later regained my composure. I just felt in a case like that, it was given to me. It came from professionals who did the examinations, and the reader should know. However painful it is, however upsetting it is to read it. And that's the same thing with the stories of the castrations. I mean, I find the stories of the sexual abuses so disturbing. Emotionally disturbing that after doing a number of stories on the subject, I decided to try to focus on other things because I just found I got to a point I couldn't keep on asking questions. Mm-hmm. I couldn't even define what had happened. It's just so disturbing.
We've talked a little bit about camps that you believe to be death camps that you were able to document the existence of through interviews with survivors. You were given a tour of one of the camps, Manyachka, am I saying?
Manyachka, right.
Yeah. What was it like for you to be given, you know, limited access to one of these camps, to be given limited access to prisoners there, with this kind of controlled tour that you get? How can you get to see what it is you want to see?
The story came back to me the moment I entered Manyachka, of the Red Cross visiting, I'm trying to think, was it Treblinka or one of the camps during the Nazi period? And the Nazis brought out a string orchestra and performed for the International Red Cross. And the Red Cross went away saying that this was everything seemed to be just fine in this place. And history can never repeat itself quite so blatantly. But I was just prepared for show and tell, for some people call it a dog and pony show. I was prepared that whatever they presented me, I had to either have complete and full access and private conversations with prisoners, otherwise nothing would be credible. So I got to Manyachka with my photographer. As we drove up to the place, we could see in the distance in the fields men with shaved heads looking very gaunt, Digging what looked like another perimeter fence of barbed wire. And we got closer to the place. We saw signs up saying minefields. Now, the idea of mining fields to prevent prisoners from escaping, it was a stunning thing. Inside the camp, they presented seven or eight prisoners to me. And I was in the most awkward situation I think I've ever been in as a reporter, because I didn't have my interpreter along. She was doing some research for me that day. The Army, which had organized the trip, didn't have a reporter along. For some reason, all the local press had gone to Belgrade, or they were out of town that day. So I was, but they did bring a camera along, and I found myself incredibly put in the position where I was supposed to interview the prisoners, and the army would record it on the camera, and obviously would be on that evening's news as American reporter interviews prisoners and reports that everything is just fine. And it was a situation that you simply could not let stand. Because I would be totally compromised, and so would the prisoners, and it would be a terrible faking of a story.
So what did you do?
Well, I started talking to one prisoner. I saw the cameras were rolling. I said to the person behind the camera, I said, "You take over. I can't do this. This is not right." And I backed off a bit. And later I went up to some of the prisoners directly with my little tape recorder. I speak the language to some degree, but it's not really good enough to do a proper interview. But I just asked them, "Who are you? Where are you from? Why are you here? And what are the conditions like?" And they spoke into the tape recorder. And later I had my interpreter translate. And I learned from this that none of them was really a prisoner of war. A prisoner of war, by definition, is somebody who's been carrying arms and who's taken up arms against the army and is then captured. But none of these people had arms, they said. They didn't know why they had been captured. And the conditions there, they didn't want to talk about that, but I later learned that the conditions were really appallingly bad.
Roy Gutman's Pulitzer Prize-winning reports on ethnic cleansing in Bosnia are collected in his new book, A Witness to Genocide. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Gutman will be back with us in the second part of our show.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, more with journalist Roy Gutman about reporting on genocide in Bosnia. Gutman wrote the first in-depth reports on the Serbian-run death camps. His reports on the camps and on the systematic rape of Bosnian women won a Pulitzer Prize this year for international reporting. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews the new season. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has signed two side deals to the North American Free Trade Agreement. He was joined at the signing ceremony today by former Presidents George Bush, Jimmy Carter, and Gerald Ford. The pact would create the world's largest free trade zone among Canada, Mexico, and the United States. President Clinton says the pact would create jobs, not destroy them, as opponents claim.
I believe that NAFTA will create 1 million jobs in the first 5 years. Of its impact. And I believe that that is many more jobs than will be lost, as inevitably some will be, as always happens when you open up the mix to a new range of competition. NAFTA will generate these jobs by fostering an export boom to Mexico, by tearing down tariff walls, which have been lowered quite a bit by the present administration of President Salinas, but are still higher than Americans.
The main trade agreement would eliminate tariffs and other barriers to trade. Congress must approve the pact, but the White House, hoping to build support for the troubled legislation over time, won't submit it to lawmakers until later this fall. The University of Pennsylvania has reached a decision in the case against students charged with confiscating the campus newspaper. Robbie Harris of member station WHYY reports from Philadelphia.
The university ruled it will take no disciplinary action against a group of students charged with confiscating the newspapers, but warned that any future incidents of the kind will be dealt with swiftly and severely. Last April, the Black Student League, an on-campus group at the University of Pennsylvania, removed an entire run of the Daily Pennsylvanian, the student newspaper, from university distribution boxes. The students said the act was in protest against a columnist they called racist. According to the university, Penn is one of 15 campuses nationwide on which similar incidents have been reported. University officials are urging members of the Black Student League to work out their differences with the editors of the Daily Pennsylvanian. For National Public Radio, I'm Robbie Harris in Philadelphia.
Inflation at the consumer level is up. The Labor Department reports that price hikes for fruit, cars, and clothes offset a record drop in tobacco prices and the cost of energy last month. The agency's consumer price index rose a modest 0.3% in August. The Commerce Department says retail sales rose in August for the fifth time in as many months. It's the longest string of advances in nearly a year. The agency says August's 0.2% gain came as a surprise to some analysts who had expected no change because of low consumer confidence and slow job creation. Stocks closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow lost more than 18 points to end the day at 3,615.76. Declines led advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. Jury selection began today in the trial of four Muslims charged in the World Trade Center bombing. Jurors will be selected from a pool of 5,000 candidates. It's one of the biggest groups ever assembled for a federal trial. Observers say it will probably take weeks to choose an anonymous 12-member panel. Defense attorneys lost a fight yesterday when the judge refused to create a questionnaire for jurors. He plans to question prospective panelists himself. Police officers are standing guard outside the federal courthouse where the trial will take place. The New York City Democratic primary elections are underway. Gene Brian Johnson of member station WNYC reports that while Mayor David Dinkins is expected to win, the city's chief financial officer's bid may be in trouble.
Former Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman is in a tough battle for her political life. She's running against another former congressman, Herman Badillo, and state legislator Alan Hevesy. Until recently, Holtzman had a comfortable lead in the polls, but charges that she knowingly borrowed $450,000 from a banking and securities firm seeking to do business with the city have hurt her. Holtzman came to national prominence as an outspoken member of the House Judiciary Committee during the Watergate hearings, but she's lost two attempts to become a United States Senator. Before becoming controller, she was elected Brooklyn District Attorney, heading one of the nation's largest prosecutor's offices. For National Public Radio, this is Gene Brian Johnson in New York.
AMR Corporation, the parent to American Airlines, will cut 5,000 workers and ground more aircraft by the end of next year. Corporation President Robert Crandall says the carrier must reduce high labor costs. AMR has more than 119,000 employees on its payroll. The cuts include AMR's plans to slice 200 to 300 management staffers. Many of the cuts are to come through early retirement, attrition, and layoffs. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Roy Gutman's reports on ethnic cleansing in Bosnia won a 1993 Pulitzer Prize, the Overseas Press Club Award, the George Polk Award, and the International League of Human Rights Award. Gutman was the first journalist to report in depth on mass murder in Serb-run prison camps. He also reported on the systematic rape of Bosnian women. Gutman is a foreign correspondent for the New York newspaper Newsday. His Pulitzer Prize-winning articles are collected in the new book, A Witness to Genocide. We invited him back for the second part of our show to continue our conversation about his startling reports. What do you think the impact was of your reporting on what you described as death camps in Bosnia?
It's funny. I only learned it 2 or 3 months later that it was immediate. It was startling. It led the Serbs to close down at least two camps, and I think it probably led in a kind of a chain reaction to either the closing of other camps, and there, you know, there may have been 60, 80, or 100 camps throughout Bosnia, or to slight improvements in the conditions for the prisoners, because I think this routinized beating and torturing and killing of people was affected. For some weeks, the story itself had a tremendous impact worldwide, especially because the photographs that came out a few days later that showed the conditions in the camps. But nobody could actually prove, by going to the scene, and this is where what most reporters did, nobody could prove at the scene the story that I had written. And the reason was very simple, that you cannot prove something when you're in a situation of total intimidation and terror by talking to witnesses, because nobody will tell you the truth. And to my great regret, very few people followed up on the story by finding witnesses once they were finally released. But in other words, the full picture didn't come about for some time of just what happened. It took months before we figured it out. But as I say, then I discovered that the effect of the story was dramatic.
How did the story become more clear over time?
Well, there were two ways. For the longest time, the U.S. government and other governments, they went back and forth. They first said they thought the stories could be accurate, then they said they had no evidence and so on. A State Department official named George Kenney resigned at the end of August in Washington. He had been, in fact, the Bosnia desk officer, complaining that the department was not seriously pursuing stories such as mine. Together with officials at the U.S. Embassy in Zagreb, people at the State Department organized a team to go to refugee camps in Croatia, just as I had done, and start interviewing. They did this seriously. It went on for months. They contacted hundreds of refugees, and the documentation they provided is really staggering. I did the same thing. I went back to the story. I waited for the first group of Omarska prisoners to be released. It took until October. This is from August to October. And they were released to a camp in southern Croatia at Karlovac. I went there the day after they arrived. I stayed there for several days. At the same time, a group was released of the worst-off prisoners, the ill or most wounded prisoners, to go to England, 60 or 70 men. And I went there and I talked to them. I think I was the only reporter to do that. But by talking to them individually, having them each tell me their story and what he saw, I could compile an account of what really happened at Omarska. Now, I only focused on the one camp. I only talked to maybe 20 or 30 people who had been there. But their stories corroborated. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I went back to northern Bosnia. I went back to Omarska itself. And I got the official tour given to me by the officials. And I told them what I'd heard from some of the prisoners about the conditions. And I said, you tell me your story. What really happened to the people here? And I gave them a list of names of people who supposedly had disappeared at Omarska. They included the mayor of the town of Prijedor. And we sat down. I went through my list. And they would tell me, well, this person disappeared without trace. This person may have died in the camp. This person never was in the camp. And at the end of the time, I said, look, it looks like terrible things have happened here. I've got many witnesses. And the officials, this is the Serb official, said to me, you have your story, we have our story. You can pick which one you think is the truth. And so, in a sense, they confirmed it by saying that they only have an official version of what happened, and that by going to the survivors, I probably did find out the truth of it.
Did you print that comment, you have your story, we have ours?
Yes, I did, in fact. I did a long piece about Omarska in October, then another piece about the intellectuals, the city officials, the teachers, and others who seem to have been killed there. And I think I may have used the comment twice because it came up in both contexts.
You write that one of the questions you asked was this: if you were finding out about mass executions and mass rapes in Bosnia, how come the American government didn't seem to know about it? How come the Red Cross wasn't talking about it yet? What do you think about that now?
I mean, it's one of the most troubling aspects of all the events in Bosnia. We have overhead satellite capability. We can photograph camps. The United States could do this readily. Many people were emerging, and the international organizations were quite capable of collating the data that was coming in. So why did nobody else report it? Why was it left to a reporter to come up with a story? I can only guess. I think, though, you can look back at World War II as well and try to ask why did the Western countries do nothing about the camps that were set up then. In the case of Bosnia, for some reasons I can only speculate about, the Bush administration decided that they would look the other way as the Serbs conquered Bosnia. And when the United States does that, in the context of our alliance with the West European countries, nobody is about to break ranks and do something themselves. Governments really are the institutions which have to keep an eye on these massive human rights abuses. And if governments deliberately close their eyes, then the abuses will multiply.
My guest is Roy Guttman. His Pulitzer Prize-winning reports on ethnic cleansing in Bosnia are collected in the new book, A Witness to Genocide. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Roy Guttman, foreign correspondent for the New York newspaper Newsday. I know some journalists who've been covering the war in the Balkans who really feel that American military intervention wouldn't solve the problem, that the situation really is so complex. And although one side has been responsible for more atrocities and so on than the other sides, it really isn't a situation of just good guys and just bad guys. And it's not a situation that military intervention would solve. Do you disagree with that?
I think that people often call the war in Bosnia a war. It's common to talk about warring parties. To my mind, a situation where you have one side with 90% of the arms, with aggressive intentions, with an ideology that calls for the conquest of territory and practices that amount to the elimination of the population, the extermination of the population, in fact, is not really to be described as a war, but as a slaughter. So first of all, it does command our attention and our interest because this shouldn't happen, not only shouldn't happen in Europe, it shouldn't happen anywhere, but in Europe, where people live in and nations are in such close proximity, you simply have to worry about the impact of something happening in one location on next door. But that's not really the answer to your question. The fact is that air power would even the sides tremendously. Airstrikes would. Look, you've got Sarajevo under siege. There are thousands of artillery pieces on the hills outside of Sarajevo that the Serbs use to fire into the city. It wouldn't take General Patton or some other brilliant general very long to figure out, or any general to figure out what to do in Sarajevo. You simply knock out a third of the pieces of artillery, and you liberate Sarajevo. This is no huge military problem. As for the rest of Bosnia, well, I don't know. I think that there are hundreds of thousands of people whose loyalty is to the legal and legitimate government of Bosnia who are prepared to lay down their lives to regain the cities and towns and the territory that has been lost and to get back their homes. But they have no arms.
Where are we now in terms of the negotiations and the peace process in the Balkans?
Well, peace process has to be described, you know, in quotation marks, mm-hmm. because this is not really a peace process. This is a process by the European governments in particular, the European community, and the United Nations for wishing away the problem and not solving it. Today, there is a meeting in Geneva of the steering committee of the Bosnia peace talks. The United States is part of the steering committee, as are the European governments. They've got to decide whether to proceed with this charade in Geneva or to reconstitute it in some other form. They've got to decide whether finally force has to be used as a threat to back up the idea of negotiations, or whether these negotiations are simply going to continue in a kind of a vacuum in which the Serbs, the Serb conquerors of Bosnia, are the only ones using force, and there's no sign anywhere of counterforce. So in the next day or so, we may have a better idea of whether Europe and the United States are prepared to take a new tack.
So you still think there's the possibility of America using force in the Balkans?
I think ultimately there's no way around it. Because if they don't stop this conquest in Bosnia, where, in fact, which is a recognized country with recognized boundaries, then it will spread to other places because aggressors take appeasement as an encouragement to conquer other territories. Precisely when, precisely under what circumstances the intervention takes place, I don't know, but I think that they're never satisfied. Aggressors are never satisfied, and that much we must recall from the history of World War II.
Are you still reporting on the Balkans?
I am. I was in Sarajevo last month. I'm just finishing up an investigative piece. I hope in the next few days. That relates just how the United Nations has dealt with the whole issue of concentration camps. I'm preparing to go back into Bosnia within about a week.
Do you want to go back? Would you like to just kind of be free of the story? Not only because I'm sure you'd want the war to end, but do you feel like you've just, like, seen and had enough of it? Do you wish you could get on to something else? Or do you feel compelled to return and cover it till the war is over?
Well, I suppose all of the above.
You want to get away from it and you feel compelled to go back?
Yeah, it's a draining experience. It's harder to cover as time goes on. It's harder to get interest and attention for the story. On the other hand, I feel the press, in this case, the international media, have made a difference, have helped save some lives, have helped focus the attention on something really important, and we have an obligation to continue.
Roy Gutman's Pulitzer Prize-winning reports on ethnic cleansing in Bosnia are collected in the new book, A Witness to Genocide. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what are you doing today to follow up on yesterday's peace agreement between Israel and the PLO?
Well, Terry, today we are trying to look a little bit beyond the agreement to the agenda between the United States and Jordan, the reaction to this agreement in Jordan, and then Robert Siegel, who, as you know, has been in Israel, visited the Golan Heights, which could be the subject of discussions with Syria. So we're thinking the next step. Yasser Arafat is still here. We'll have a report on his activities and visit with some American Palestinians on what they think. Also, we have a blue-footed booby sighting.
Really? Okay. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Now that all the entries are in the late-night TV battle, the networks are hoping to generate equal excitement over their new prime-time lineups. But TV critic David Bianculli isn't impressed.
A few years ago, I interviewed Randy Newman about a cable TV special he was doing, and we got talking about how TV was different when we were kids. I remember that now not only because it was a really goofy digression, but because Randy Newman admitted to something I can't stop thinking about at this time of year. He said that when he was a kid, he would wait each September for the fall preview issue of TV Guide and go through it very excitedly to find out what new shows would be on TV that year. In the 50s and 60s, that's the way it was. Even bad shows like My Mother the Car would stick around for a whole year and be replaced the next fall. So the fall season, which had been developed in the first place so the automobile industry could get a big advertising audience for its fall line of cars, was a big deal. At least to people like Randy Newman and me, who cared a lot about TV. But the other thing that Randy Newman said, with a laugh, was that he just couldn't imagine anyone getting that excited about the fall season anymore. And he's right. It's my job to get excited about the fall season, and even I can't get up the energy. There's something really wrong here. First of all, 1993 is a weak TV year. There are tons of family sitcoms, but almost no funny ones. The best of the bunch is Frasier, the Cheers spinoff that begins this Thursday. There aren't many new dramas, and the best of them is the unnecessarily controversial NYPD Blue, which I'll review next week. And one of the most enjoyable shows to watch this season is Pure Fantasy, Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman, and it deserves a big up-up and hooray. Clark Kent, played by Dean Cain, is a strong character for a change, even though he still phones his foster parents for help and advice.
Maybe it's a crazy idea, but Mom, how's your sewing machine? Is it still working?
I think so.
Well, I have a favor to ask. I think I need some kind of outfit.
Outfit?
Well, you know, like a disguise I could wear when things like that explosion happen. I could... Mom, I gotta go. Lois is here.
Oh, Lois again, huh?
But with more shows than ever premiering this year in primetime, that's a pretty short list. And shows are canceled after a few weeks if they don't make it in the ratings, or they're moved where no one can find them. A lot of the new fall shows have premiered already, even though the season doesn't begin officially until next Monday. And who can tell the difference between a summer series like Tall Hopes and a fall series like The Trouble with Larry, when both of them premiere on the same network the same night? What's most discouraging of all, most of the good shows, when they appear, last less than a season. So why should viewers seek out and get hooked on good new shows that probably won't be given a chance to grow? It's a good question. And right now, I don't think the networks have an answer, or even a clue.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director is Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, some surprises about one of the most authoritative voices of stage and screen. James Earl Jones tells us about his stutter and about why he virtually stopped speaking in public when he was growing up. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.